And you are Mr.?
Watson, Your Honor.
Mr. Watson, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Ryan Watson. I represent the appellants, the Burkettes, in this matter. There are several issues in this case, so unless the Court has any other questions they would like to start with, I'm going to begin by discussing why the District Court erred in applying the misrepresentation exception for three specific reasons. One, there did exist an independent operational duty for DHHS to notify the adoptive parents in this matter. Two, the Court erred in applying the tort in the misrepresentation exception because the tort of misrepresentation was not pled in this matter. Rather, general negligence was pled. There is a distinction between the tort of misrepresentation versus general negligence involving misrepresentation as a component. Three, the misrepresentation exception should not apply when failing to disclose the history of an adoptee as a matter of public policy. And if I can, I will then later address that the law of the case doctrine precluded the Court from considering immunity at trial. So to begin, in regards to the independent operational duty, the Court erred because DHHS did have an independent operational duty. Now, I'll begin by stating that the state did judicially admit through the answer to the Second Amended Complaint that it had negligently failed to disclose the ward's history to the plaintiffs. And their only shelter lies in the affirmative defense of the immunity under the misrepresentation exception to the State Tort Claims Act. But State v. Wickersham, this Court stated, where there exists an independent operational duty to notify, the state cannot claim the misrepresentation exception. So the question is there an independent operational duty to notify? Well, that was answered in Furman v. State, when this Court stated, and I'll quote, based on the facts of the case, we have previously recognized that when DHHS had ample information that a state ward had a history of violent and abusive behavior and was faced with questions regarding the potential risk posed to children who were exposed to the ward, DHHS had a duty to answer truthfully as to any knowledge it had or later acquired as to the ward's violent propensities and any danger that other children might encounter by being left alone with the ward. That was in Furman v. State. They were citing a previous case from the Nebraska Supreme Court, Anderson v. William, the Nebraska Department of Social Services, which generally cited Johnson v. State of California, which we've cited in our brief, which stands for this proposition. Now, the facts are that it is undisputed the plaintiffs asked about the history of the ward. It is undisputed that the ward was going to be placed where he'd be in contact with the other children. It is undisputed that DHHS knew about the ward's history and did not disclose it to the plaintiffs. Under Furman v. State and Anderson v. Couillon, it should be undisputed that DHHS had a duty to disclose. But the problem is, the state relied on Stonacek v. City of Lincoln, which is a grave departure from the facts that we have in this case. In Stonacek v. City of Lincoln, the plaintiffs in that case complained of misrepresentation of what I believe were floodplain documents. So they built their homes, flood occurs, they were out several thousands of dollars due to the damage to their homes. That itself is a misrepresentation claim because you have the key element of pecuniary loss. And so here we have the distinction between the tort of misrepresentation versus general negligence involving misrepresentation as a component. Another key example would be if you have, and this is often cited by other courts who've dealt with this issue, if you have a state employee who's driving a car, and he fails to use his turn signal, but makes an abrupt left turn and causes an accident. Was his failure to disclose his turn misrepresentation, such as though a claim against the state would be a claim for the tort of misrepresentation? No, that is general negligence. That is just general negligence. Another example would be if a subdivision were to time a crosswalk for 10 seconds. But in reality, it ran faster than that. Is that misrepresentation that that person crossing the street only has 10 seconds? Is that a tort of misrepresentation? Or is that just general negligence to not check the timing of the crosswalk? So here we have a distinction. We have the distinction between the tort of misrepresentation itself versus misrepresentation as a component of general negligence. And so when the court applied the misrepresentation exception, it did so assuming that the plaintiffs had pled the tort of misrepresentation, when in reality, it had pled general negligence. And now the test for this that was applied before was the gravamen of the complaint test. But I think that test is in error. First off, it's very inartful. In most cases that do have to deal with it, don't go on to discuss what the body of the complaint stated. And so it makes for bad case law to try to go back and determine what exactly was in the complaint and what decides what really is the difference in the gravamen of a complaint in
Are you saying you can plead around the exception to the Tort Claims Act by alleging general negligence as opposed to misrepresentation, which would in fact be the basis of the negligence claim?
Well, I'd actually be advocating for a different test so that isn't allowed. What I would be advocating for is that the court recognize that the tort of misrepresentation required pecuniary loss, just like it did in Derry v. Peake, dating back to the common law of England. That by doing so, then the court can make a clear distinction anytime it's presented with a case like this of whether we're dealing with misrepresentation that the state can seek immunity under versus negligence, which it cannot.
Is that something this court should do, or is that something the legislature should do?
I think that's something really that the legislature has already done and that this court needs to interpret as applying as such. Because if the state has argued in its brief that, well, the plain language of misrepresentation is essentially deceitful or fraud. But that renders the other words, deceit and fraud, in the Intentional Torts Act superfluous, which is against one of the pillars of statutory construction. I don't know how you can go on and define misrepresentation without using possibly the words deceit or fraud, and vice versa. And furthermore, if we discuss plain language, we need to consider the context.
What relief are you seeking?
What we'd be asking the court is that because of the judicial admissions through the answer to the second amended complaint, is that if the misrepresentation exception does not apply, the state should be found liable. We'd be asking the court to remand it down for a decision on damages.
Well, you're still asking for pecuniary loss.
Well, we would be asking for... What I mean that pecuniary loss, what I'm discussing is an element of. So just a financial loss. And that is where the tort of misrepresentation really was developed. Misrepresentations that were a cause of financial loss. And
as
so,
opposed to just damages for your wrongful conduct.
Correct.
Okay.
We have said many times that waivers of sovereign immunity are to be strictly construed. How does the doctrine of strict construction fit in with the argument that you are making?
Well, I guess I've made two arguments here. First, that I think we had an independent operational duty that we've pled. But second, and I think this is what you're referring to, is the argument that would require that pecuniary loss be an element of the tort of misrepresentation. I think the doctrine of strict construction would still have to take for account what is the plain meaning of misrepresentation. I mean, I don't think the plain meaning of misrepresentation automatically suggests that we revert directly to the Merriam-Webster's dictionary. I think there needs to be some sense of we have lawmakers who are determining legal remedies using legal terminology. The legal terminology of the misrepresentation is that, and I guess the best way to look at it, there's no coincidence that the intentional torts listed in the restatement first and second is the same exact intentional torts that are listed in the exceptions, almost word for word in order. Assault, battery, I can't remember the others, but misrepresentation, fraud, and deceit is literally listed directly in that order. And I don't think that's any coincidence. And so I don't think the strict construction means that we give the state all complete deference as to what it could possibly be. I just think it means that we have to be judicious and reasonable in how we're going to interpret it.
How does you refer to the judicial admissions?
Correct.
How does that square? This went to trial, is that right?
Yes. Well, I think...
Do those evaporate or do they control the trial?
Well, I think ultimately what the court would do is it would reverse the court's decision that immunity applies in this. And then I think in order to save time, I think the court could just find that the state is liable because when it goes back down, I think that's a question that the court would deal with, which is already answered. I mean, without the immunity exception, they've generally admitted it. So that, I mean, that could be decided by this court.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what exercise you do first. This is great. This, if they're not immune from liability, then you go on to the merits.
Correct. And I think they've admitted those. I think they've admitted the merits of our case. And if there's no further questions, I reserve the remainder. Well, since I'm out of time here. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kumari, is that correct?
David Lopez.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lopez.
Good
morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Dave Lopez, Assistant Attorney General representing the state. There is no commercial requirement in the misrepresentation exception to the State Tort Claims Act. The legislature didn't put one there. This court has not found one there. And it is far from settled that a similar requirement exists in the corresponding provision of the Federal Tort Claims Act, which contains the identical language. There are three essential conclusions that compel affirmance of Judge Korslund's decision following trial. First, we know as a matter of fact, as the district court concluded, that Jodine Gall, the former DHHS caseworker, misrepresented the truth of KDM's sexualized history to the Burkitts when they asked.
If the Burkitts hadn't asked, would the answer, would the state's answer have included the affirmative defense of misrepresentation? Does everything turn on the fact that these parents had the foresight to ask?
Well, certainly it makes this case a lot easier in terms of finding misrepresentation, but even if they hadn't, I think from the Stanicek decision, this court would still conclude that the misrepresentation exception applies because it is broad enough to include a failure to convey information or even in going and seeking it out.
Well, there's a duty to speak here under the circumstances where they know the conduct of the child is something that parents would normally want to know if they're going to start raising this kid in their home. So the fact that the parents didn't ask doesn't change the situation, does it?
Well, I guess I would quarrel with the premise only from the standpoint that the particular facts before the case, before the court, do involve a situation where the caseworker was asked. She knew.
Okay.
She knew the truth of KDM's sexualized history, and did not convey it when asked repeatedly. And under Stanicek, whether the court wishes to view it as negligent misrepresentation or intentional misrepresentation or something in between, it nevertheless is misrepresentation that the legislature has indicated in the exemption is barred from the State Tort Claims Act. Now, this case turns on whether the court is to interpret that when the legislature included misrepresentation and deceit and everything else in 81.8.219 sub 4, that they meant torts. And the state's position is if they meant torts, they knew how to use the word tort. And if they had added three words and said arising out of the torts of, etc., then this argument would fail. But consistent with the doctrine that the statutes purporting to waive the sovereign immunity must be strictly construed in the state's favor, and that the court must look for express and explicit language to find such a waiver, I simply don't think there's enough in the State Tort Claims Act exemptions provision to read that the legislature meant for misrepresentation to mean the tort of misrepresentation, such that it might include a commercial interest requirement.
Why would they be talking about anything other than torts in the Tort Claims Act?
Well, I would turn to, for example, this court's decision in Johnson, where you very specifically said, and this was interpreting the assault or battery exception within the same statute. And the court said it's not just the claim of, it's anything arising out of claim of assault or battery. To answer your question, Justice Stacey, I guess the answer doesn't necessarily need to be asked because the question doesn't need to be answered from the standpoint that the legislature didn't include sufficient language to find a waiver. And I mean, I think that's particularly true when we're talking about creating state liability for an entire set of claims beyond misrepresentations that might have had some kind of invasion of a commercial interest. This is something that has been echoed throughout the federal decisions interpreting the corresponding provision at the federal level. And if the,
aren't the federal cases predominantly in the direction that it is commercial?
Yes, as are the court's cases. But that's only a byproduct of the fact, and I haven't lost sight of your question, Mr. Chief Justice, but that's only by a byproduct of the fact that the state has not asserted the exception in other personal injury cases, which candidly seem to recur in this, on this particular fact pattern, HHS failing to convey some kind of particularly important piece of information.
Your opposing counsel, pardon me, excuse me, is saying roughly this isn't a commercial case.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah, and the exception has come up and been analyzed often when there has been a commercial case. But our point is, there's no requirement in the statute, in the exemption statute, that it has to be a commercial case for the exception to apply. In order to get there, you'd have to find that the legislature meant tort when it put misrepresentation. And to answer your question, Mr. Chief Justice, the yes, a lot of the federal cases have come up in that regard or in that context, but we hinted in our brief that there are others that haven't. And if the court would forgive a late citation, in addition to the NABAR case from the District of Minnesota, in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, just even more recently, and the site is 20, it's La Loop, L-A-L-O-U-P, 29 F sub 3rd 530, beginning at page 540 of the decision. The court declined to make a ruling on it, but it actually did a pretty useful survey on how the circuits have split on this. And my ultimate point is, federal courts in at least the 3rd, 8th, and 9th Circuit have found, addressing the question head on, that the exception can be applicable in a non-commercial case. Now, that means at best, within the federal judiciary, that the question has not been conclusively resolved, meaning the Block and Neustadt cases, which this court relied on in Stanicek in delineating the broad outline of the misrepresentation exception and whether it could be negligent or intentional for it to apply, is unsettled. And that's obviously not dispositive on this court making a determination of Nebraska law, but you've said in Johnson that given that the STCA is patterned after the FTCA, that those decisions are persuasive. And I would simply rebut the notion that we or the court should assume that it's a settled issue at the federal level that misrepresentation as it exists in the FTCA means the tort of misrepresentation such that there's a commercial interest requirement. I would acknowledge that this is a hard outcome given the facts of this case and would be a hard outcome if it had been asserted in some of the other personal injury cases involving state foster placements. The cases that come to mind are Moore, Anderson, Hazelhorst. But it's a hard outcome because it's undisputed that notwithstanding the fact that the Burkitt's expert witness characterized what happened between the boys in this case as child sex play that was on the less severe end of the spectrum, it's nevertheless something that should have happened and would not have happened if our former caseworker had told the truth as she had been trained to do. And as a side note, of course, Judge Korsland did conclude that she had not been negligently trained, that she did know about the information. So any notion... And I know the Burkitts have tried to relitigate this in their appellate brief, that her caseload prevented her from knowing the information, or that she had too many cases, or that the paper file was too big, or the like. The fact of the matter is the district court reached a factual conclusion that she did know this information and didn't tell it when she was asked. But my point is it's a preventable outcome, given that the Burkitts could have pursued Jodine Gall as a defendant and chose to pursue the state exclusively. In doing so, they've subjected themselves to the requirements of the State Tort Claims Act, and given that, at the very best, it is a murky question as to whether the legislature or Congress at the FTCA level intended for misrepresentation to equal tort, and thus to equal something that has a commercial interest requirement, The proper course of action is to rule that this means misrepresentation and anything arising out of misrepresentation. Similar to what the District of Minnesota concluded in the NABAR case and that other federal courts have in applying the FTCA's exemption.
I don't suppose the former caseworker was a lottery winner. In other words, isn't the remedy against the former caseworker an empty remedy?
I don't know that we know that. If I can.
Sure.
I don't know that we know that, Justice Castle. I mean, what I would say is, and I'll conclude on a policy note because I think your question does dovetail on a very important issue, which is, are we trying to ensure that there's from a policy matter, that there's a disincentive for caseworkers to hide this information? And contrary to the Burkitt's arguments, though we are in agreement on that incentive, I think the state's policy, the state carries the policy arguments here, because if our caseworkers know that if they lie, that they may be on the hook. So I would answer the question simply by saying that I think as a policy, from a policy interest standpoint, there's every interest in ensuring that caseworkers are trained and required to convey this information, don't have discretion to prioritize and pull some of it back, that they do so. And if the legislature wants to change that, they certainly can by adding 3 words.
Thank you.
We ask for affirmance.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? You had 6 seconds, but we'll give you all of 30 seconds, Mr. Watson, if you want.
I guess I would just briefly like to state, Your Honor, that it seems as if though the defendants have tried to state that Jodine Gull intentionally did this as though it relieved them of liability. If that was the case, they did not need to admit negligence on their part in their answer to the second amended complaint. I have nothing further. We ask that the court remand the matter back down for a decision on damages upon defendants liable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day, then, is State versus Travis T. Mitchell.